So it was a while back. And I'm not sure exactly how it happened, but there was a conversation in our household which I remembered as I was looking at the readings for this week, because somehow we ended up talking about the doctrine of original sin. I expect that when you imagine life in the manse, you assume that discussions like this happen all the time at the drop of the proverbial hat. But please believe me that if our dining room table could talk, it would report that discussions of shopping lists and meal plans and drum lessons and school and university assignments, and most of all, whose turn it is to try and stop Bindi from destroying everything in the house, are far more common. But I digress. The point is, there we were, talking about original sin. And I realized I had two main problems with the doctrine of original sin. The first, perhaps the most profound, is that I don't really understand what it is. And the second is that as far as I do understand it, I don't think I believe it. I can't see how justice would hold that we are to be counted sinful before we have power to act. How we can be held morally in the wrong simply by virtue of being part of the human race. It's one thing to say all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. I mean, that's just obvious. You see it confirmed 1,000 times a day. But to say all are born tainted by the sin of Adam, that doesn't make sense, at least to me. If it does to you, please explain it to me at some point. I promise I'll listen. But worse, it seems also that that understanding denies another central tenet of our faith, that God creates good, that the God who created us creates things which are good. We mar the image of God in which we are created, but that does not deny the fact that we were made in that image. So that's why today I actually chose one of the alternative readings for the Old Testament. You may have noticed from Sirach. Sometimes that book is known as Ecclesiasticus, not to be confused, as I have done embarrassingly in the past, with Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiasticus, which isn't found in many of our Bibles, but any Bible in a Catholic church or an Orthodox church would contain it, as part of what are known as the deuterocanonical books. If it's included in our Bibles, in the Protestant tradition, it would normally be there as the Apocrypha, which is a collection of writings from the Jewish tradition between the end of the Old Testament as we have it and the time of Jesus. A collection of writings that cover that period that we don't include because back about 400 years before Jesus, Jewish scholars of the time set out what their canon would be. And that's what we take as our Old Testament, the Hebrew canon. But it was very much part of the tradition of the Jewish faith of Jesus' day, and indeed still today. They were part, these books, of that debate, that argument that I often talk about, that was going on within Judaism, about what faith was meant to look like in a time and place that was very different from the kingdom of David and the kingdom of Solomon that they looked back to. Very different to time in the promised land as their own kingdom. And the passage that we heard read today goes to the heart, in a way, of the nature of sin, or at least one aspect of the nature of sin. And the question of original sin. And the writer of these words didn't get bogged down in many of the discussions that I would probably love to have of human depravity, of nature versus nurture, of free will versus the sovereignty of God. For the author of Sirach, the matter is actually pretty straightforward. If you choose, you can keep the commandments. Acting faithfully is a matter of your own choice. Problem is, that doesn't actually always seem to be true. Week by week, we come on a Sunday, and often we come with a prayer of confession, spoken together or spoken in our own silence. Because each week, if we're being honest with ourselves, we know that we need that. If acting faithfully is a choice, if keeping God's commandments is our choice, we seem to be very good at making bad choices. Maybe actually that's it. That's why we need to come with confession. Because we feel that we actually do have a choice as to how we will live. And because we have a choice, we are responsible for our failings. If we had no choice, if keeping God's commands was utterly beyond us, it would in a way make no sense to feel guilty, make no sense to seek, no meaning in seeking forgiveness, if it wasn't something we had any control over. But equally, if we had no choice, there would also be no place for hope. For it is that sense that we could choose differently. That sense that we could change, which gives us hope for a future which is not condemned to be like the past. We are not condemned by our genetics or our character or our fundamental humanness to keep repeating the same mistakes over and over and over again. We will, but at least maybe there'll be different mistakes. There's a passage in a children's book, I think it's probably one of the Enid Blyton school stories, which I vaguely remember from a long time ago, but the little exchange stuck in my mind. One of the characters, one of the kids at the school, says to the principal, probably the headmistress, since it was Enid Blyton, "I keep promising I'm going to change. I'm not going to lose my temper anymore, but I keep on doing it, and you're not going to believe me." And the principal replies, "I will believe you every time. And one day, you'll find you've kept your promise." The fact that our wrong choices are our responsibility is not, by God's grace, cause for despair. In the end, it's actually our only source of hope. And that's the context in which we read Jesus' words from the Sermon on the Mount. Words about relationships, words about guilt and confession and reconciliation. And what true religion actually looks like. So you probably noticed in today's gospel reading, Jesus begins by setting the bar incredibly, ridiculously high. do not murder. That's probably a commandment most of us could get behind and be fairly confident of keeping. But don't get angry with your sister or brother. Don't insult them. Don't call them a fool. I wonder how many times a day each one of us falls short of that ideal. And if ever there was a command it seems hard to choose to keep, don't get angry, surely is it. How do you choose not to be angry? How do you choose your emotional response to a situation? Oh, and perhaps you can't, but you read on. Because the choice isn't the anger, the choice is what comes next. The choice is not, will you get angry? Will you get hurt? Will you get disappointed? The choice is, when you do, what will you do about it? When you realize that something maybe that you've done or something that someone else has done stands between two people, between you and another beloved child of God. When a wrong, unaddressed, real or perceived, poisons a relationship, the choice is, what are you going to do about it? And so Jesus says, when you realize that that's happened, when you realize, he says, that your brother has something against you, choose. Even if you are on the point of bringing your offering to God, even if you are standing there before the altar, the high point for the Jew of religious observance, the high point in a sense of spirituality, even if you are there, stop. Don't delay. Go and seek reconciliation first. That is actually the choice that Jesus puts before his listeners. To act faithfully or not, to seek as far as you are able to be reconciled or not. And like all other choices that we make in our life, that too is a choice that we will often get wrong. But by the grace of God, our past poor choices don't condemn us. They don't condemn us to a future of repeating them, because it is a choice that we make. So there is hope for a future, an opportunity to do things differently next time, to choose again. The life of discipleship being incrementally changed into the character of the person God created us to be. That turned out to be a sort of unofficial theme of this series before Lent. I didn't plan it that way, it's just emerged out of the readings, that discipleship is this process of incremental change. That we make decisions, we make choices which have real consequences and inevitably, at least some of the time, we get them wrong, we choose badly. But the gospel offers us two precious gifts in response to that truth. Firstly, that there is always the offer of forgiveness, of a new start. That no choice we've made, however wrong or harmful it might have been, defines us out of the love and grace of God. And second, that as disciples of Jesus, we are being incrementally changed. That there is hope for a future which is different, better than our past. That even though we fail and fail and fail again, and each time we come and we promise before God that we will strive to do better, and God keeps on believing us and trusting us, and one day we'll find that we have kept our promise, that we have chosen rightly. Amen.